Hi everyone, welcome to the All Things XR podcast. In today's episode, I have Aryan Qashqai from Earthling VC. Hi Aryan.
Hi, Mujtaba. Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Welcome to the All Things XR podcast. So Aryan, can you tell us about your journey from being a machine learning engineer at Meta to becoming a founding partner at Earthling VC?
Yeah. I mean, I think I never know where to start the story, but, you know, I think the high level is, you know, I never really saw myself as much of a kind of corporate guy. And, you know, I had like a background of making startups and failing and all of that. And I think one of the things I learned through my startup journey was, you know, probably about almost 10 years ago now, you know, I had to build a ranking system for one of the startups that I was building at the time. And so that was kind of, you know, ranking systems are machine learning. And so I think, long story short, that was the first time I engaged with tech where I was really like, wow, this is primitive. You know, and I always like to remind the audience that like 10 years ago, building AI models was not what it is today with ChatGPT and all that stuff. It was like, you know, it was pretty primitive. It was like stuff you're running on your laptop. It was C code, right? Like, wasn't really that sexy. But, you know, you got a flavor, I think, of, you can start to see where this is going to go in terms of just, you know, kind of human computer relationship and all of that. And so I just was like, I just felt like I want to be part of that. And so, you know, closed down the startup, went back to school, so basically focused all my academia on machine learning. And so I got specifically, I think more by convenience, just down the natural language and social media route. So, you know, contributed to research and projects that were in academia that were related to you know, natural language problems within the social media domain, which is how I ended up at Meta. You know, because that was kind of a good natural fit, obviously, because, you know, that particularly at that time, this was like 2018-ish, you know, there was a lot of this focus on Russian misinfo and integrity and that kind of thing, which, of course, natural language problems in the social media domain. So it was pretty natural fit. And, you know, honestly, I made that decision, I think, to just go to Facebook also just sheerly financially, you know, at the time. I was like, you know, I need to just go make some money for a little while. And you know, so I felt that was like also just a good fit at the time. And, but in any case, the mistake that they made is they took me to the Oculus office the first day that I was there. And, you know, and so they put the first Rift that they put on us, which, you know, of course is a pretty primitive device, especially in today's standards. And, but I had a similar sort of reaction of like, whoa, like nobody can convince me that this is not the future. And actually before, I was actually kind of like joking about VR. I was like, oh, it's niche, and not even niche, but it's kind of like dorky and like, you know, all the typical stuff that you'd hear now, right? But, you know, and I tried it on and I was like, holy crap. Like, you know, and actually then I went home and thought about it. And I was like, you know, I can work on machine learning anywhere, any big tech company, right? I don't have to do this at Facebook, but like, if I'm already here, and I guess maybe this is partially some of the kind of startup-y entrepreneurial streak already coming, I was like, might as well just take the risk, because if I end up being right about VR, you know, I could at least say that, sure, I was at Facebook, but I was like one of the early pioneers of something huge, and I really believe in this stuff. And if it doesn't work out, well, I'm still just a, you know, engineer at Facebook, right? And, you know, my career goes on. It's not really a big deal. So it's like pretty low risk, I think. And so started going down that way. I knew also that at that point, and so anyway, I mean, so professionally that kind of put you in, kind of set up the next few years where really I was just working on, you know, spatial inference systems and stuff, primarily actually for the AR side of things they're doing within Oculus, Reality Lab, whatever you want to call it. You know, so kind of really working at that intersection of how do, you know, AI and AR VR really intersects, right? And I think that ended up being like a pretty big origin point for like what I'm doing with the fund now. But one of the other things that I took away from, you know, as I mentioned before, being a startup founder from before, was I think I'm a pretty bad CEO. And it's just not even that I'm like bad at it, but like I just don't like doing it. And I think like the kind of the core insight that I had from that was, you know, being a founder is a very vertical problem, and being a VC/angel investor is very horizontal. And so I came to the conclusion that I feel like I might be better horizontally than vertically, and it's something I want to try. And so, like, I had like no desire to be a founder again, but I was like, this investing thing could be fun. So, of course, as I mentioned, I got paid pretty well while being at Facebook, and so I was like, great, I have all this extra money laying around. I can actually start putting the companies now. And so, like, let me try it out. So I started doing a couple angel investments. Particularly at the beginning, it was quite broad in spectrum, I would say. Like, I mean, I invested in CPG, I invested in a ton of stuff before I really started to focus more down on, again, kind of like my core expertise and all of that, which was like a network building exercise, obviously. But anyway, I just determined that I really loved it. And so I just kind of kept going further down on it, and again, started to just kind of really fast forward here, like really kind of narrow down on my belief in niche, which is that, hey, like, we're going to a 3D computing paradigm, and that's both physically and digitally, frankly. And I just want to invest in technologies that are doing that, because also, again, I just understand it really well, obviously. I realized actually, like, I was one of the few people doing that, and then particularly, like, even more so, one of the very few people that was actually building it and trying to invest in it. And so, I think, long story short, that really spiraled into, I think quite a lot of, like, a lot of deal flow, a lot of networking, to where at some point I almost felt like I'm like a micro family office to some extent, because I'm basically doing all the VC things and all of that, but I'm not getting paid for it, and I'm running on my limited budget and time that I have next to my day job, right? So I was like, I think this is just the time to because I kind of believe in this, it's fun, I think I'm good at it, takes some time to tell, but I think I'm doing okay. So let me just go after this. I think it's just kind of was really just pretty innate urge, and went for it, and that's kind of been what I've been doing now. So
Awesome, great. So, Arian, you wrote a post about a year ago mentioning that it's historically awful time to start a venture fund. So
oh yeah,
why?
well, the markets are bad, right? And I mean, I think there are two ways of looking at this. And again, like, there's the fundraising side. And again, like, I think one thing particularly, because I assume a lot of your audience is probably like in the founder direction and all of that, like, company fundraising, right, usually is, of course, a product, obviously, of fund fundraising, right? Because if they're, funds have less capital to deploy, less capital going to companies, right? It's this kind of cascading ecosystem. And so I think the short answer is that there was a lot of VC pullback after, or sorry, pullback into investing into venture funds from bigger LPs, as a consequence of the kind of 2020, 2021, zero interest rate bubble, where everyone and their grandmother could raise a $10 million fund, most of which were extremely bad funds. And a lot of LPs, particularly the LPs that would be investing in smaller funds, lost a lot of money, tied up a lot of money. And combine that with, like, the regulatory environment that we have, with M&A, right, from the FTC and all of that. It just there was not a lot of just not a lot of liquidity for smaller funds in the market. That's kind of the one thing. The other consequence of that you're seeing more now is just a lot of consolidation around, really around bigger funds. Like, you're looking, like, most of the LP money now disproportionately is going to, like, the big mega funds, right, versus smaller funds. And so again, that all has, like, kind of cascading effect, because also at the end of the day, like, who's investing in pre-seed companies, right? It's not the mega funds, right? It's the small funds like mine that do, right? And so that I think is definitely a worrying trend for quite a few people in the ecosystem right now, that there's this kind of consolidation around, like, huge funds, and there's a lack of risk appetite into smaller funds. That being said, that's not to say it's not getting done. They still are. And probably a lot of funds that shouldn't exist are going out of existence, which is also a good thing, right? But that does kind of impact everybody to some extent. So, like, I think everybody in the industry is having a slow time raising, and again, that has that downstream effect, but that's kind of like the real crux of the issue right now.
I see. So, Arian, you in the post you wrote for starting Earthling VC, you elaborated on the concept of augmentative era. How do you see this paradigm shift affecting various sectors beyond obvious fields like gaming? And what are some examples of this transition in action?
Well, I think the really basic way of deducing this down is just like understanding, like thinking of computing in a more kind of meta sense. And so, like, why do we currently do what we're doing, right? In terms of like, you know, flat screen computers, flat screen, you know, phones, all of that. It's largely like a consequence of technical limitation, right? Like, I think if you'd go back 100 years, right, like, we never thought of really being this tied to like something that's just a 2D plane, right? Like, in the whole Windows UX and all the stuff. We created it because we had to, right? Because we were just limited in how we could serve things. And so this is kind of like a going back to how humans innately work, right? Like, humans, I think innately, right, us as spatial agents, right, if we think ourselves as spatial agents, we are, you know, the way we work is, you know, we have a brain, right, that sees something, that senses something, that processes that input, right, builds some sort of insight off that input, and then we have an innate drive to act upon that insight, right? Like, that's just what we do as people. The problem is computing has been largely disconnected from that. And so I think the real step that we have now is, like, you know, the AI stuff, I think, is really brought to the forefront that, hey, we can get to the insights. Like, you know, so we have computers now that are capable, you know, and I will say this very loosely, but, you know, about many things, making insights, like getting insights like people in a computer program about, like, what they're looking at and their environments and all of that. The missing key there has been, you know, the action piece on that insight. And so effectively what I think we're getting to now is this sort of part of the actually acting upon those insights. And so that virtually applies to anything, right? I mean, the way I look at it is that it's just disembodying the computing surface that we have, right? And so, yes, like, by definition, you could say, well, for example, like, you know, in a very practical sense, things like manufacturing, healthcare, right, like things like that, of course, are the very obvious kind of use cases, that construction, you know, all these sorts of things that are inherently spatial, right? They're inherently dealing with physical stuff, right? Where just like something like AR, VR, of course, naturally enables UX on that. But I think it goes further than that because, like, for example, like, you know, I if I try to explain this in layman terms all the time, it's like, think of the shift to mobile and what happened there, right? And so, like, the big unlock with mobile, if you're being very technical, was, hey, we actually have a computing device now that has a new sensor input that was not available on our laptops, right? So not only is it handheld, but, like, all of a sudden, like, we have a constantly accessible camera, right? And, like, so we basically, like, have computer vision based things, if you want to put it that way, that we can all of a sudden do with the phone, or just imaging we can do with the phone, right? That was not actually viable before, really, on a computer. Yeah. So you get things like Instagram, right? And so, like, Instagram would have not been an app that's, or Snapchat or something like that, would have not been apps that are viable, kind of pre-mobile, right? And so my argument would be that, like, yeah, we can sit and talk about, like, a bunch of use cases that we know exist that we kind of unlock, right? Again, like the healthcare stuff, like also VR, so, right? Like, you couldn't really do that with mobile. But I think the bigger thing here is that, like, there's just a category of things that will exist in that 3D paradigm that just don't exist today because they're not viable with, you know, mobile and laptops and all that stuff. And so basically the point being that, like, the next Instagram, quote unquote, will probably look a lot different in UI UX than, like, the current Instagram does, right? Like, much in the way, like, how, you know, you had Facebook before, kind of, like, and that's still in that PC era, right? And then you had Instagram kind of, like, redesigned that, right? Like, redefined social media in the mobile era. And so a lot of things, I think, like that will happen.
Exactly.
And so but the key insight here, and which is why I always, like, try to emphasize this point that, like, I think VR is something that's, like, if I always say, like, I think this whole picture, like, when I talk about VR, it's like, what I'm really talking about, it's like some sort of intersection of VR, robotics, and AI, where the real combination here being VR and robotics are basically like the ultimate interface for a lot of these things that are happening in AI, because they're the ones that enable that action piece, right? Like, so the AI creates the insight, but then all of a sudden with robots and VR and stuff, you actually create an interface where you can actually, like, you know, act in the space. And so
I see
that's very big. And one thing I always say, like, I think, you know, there's a TED talk that I think that's worth watching by Fei-Fei Li, who's, the head of, you know, Stanford HAI, whatever it's called, you know, like very acclaimed AI researcher. She calls this whole thing spatial intelligence, right? And so I always say that, like, the way she talks about spatial intelligence is actually what our fund thesis is, where she really hits on these points. She doesn't directly talk about, like, VR or something, but, you know, if you look at VR, you can look back and, like, this ties exactly into what she's trying to say, right? And so I think she possibly might mention robotics, but you could say, well, robotics and VR are on the same spectrum, actually, is kind of spatial agents and all of that, right? But yeah, that's why I think it's like, in one way or the other, like, the core technology there is like a very, very kind of like the natural next step, particularly of a lot of things that you've seen in AI. And I think that's just a point that gets like very underappreciated.
Yeah. And to also elaborate on your example in the transition to mobile, Uber comes to mind. Without GPS, you couldn't 100%. Have something like Uber. Yep. But now there's a huge industry with this transition to mobile. And Arian, how do you see the current state of AR and VR industry?
I think it depends how you want to divide it, I think is really the big thing. So there's obviously consumer, which admittedly is the stuff I kind of look at more. And then there's obviously like the enterprise side, kind of like most technologies. Mm-hmm. So I think simply put, and so, you know, I'll sort of toss it back to you after this, like, you know, in what regard, you know, specifically you're interested in. But, you know, I think the reality on the consumer side is that there is one angle that really works right now. And like, you know, if you want to build apps, it's extremely successful, which is, you know, free-to-play social VR gaming, primarily targeting kind of like Gen Alpha, Roblox generation, right? Like, those things print money. Like, if you build a good one, like, I think there's a clear path even right now where you can become like a $1 billion business. Like, I think, you know, another axiom is Gorilla Tag, right? Like, it's a $1 billion business for me, as far as, or like, if not, like, close to, right? I mean, it's very, very successful. Makes a lot of money, very profitable, extremely culturally relevant, right? There are only going to be more of these, right? Because the interesting story, of course, with a lot of the big titles like in VR right now is they're all new, right? There's so much appetite for good content in VR right now, despite the quote-unquote smallish install base, which granted is growing every year, but that you could be one of the biggest games in VR if you build a good one within 2 years. I mean, like, I have a portfolio company right now, you know, Yeeps Hide and Seek is their title, like, you know, one of the really big titles in VR right now. They released that in March, right? And they've, like, you know, they're basically already, like, effectively at the top of VR with that game. So there's a lot of opportunity there. And I would say largely in that direction. I think the insight being, like, and again, you can take this as a judgment piece, or you can just take it as a reality, and I actually take this as a good thing, that kids really like VR, like the kind of, you know, 8 to 15 kind of demographic, really, really likes VR. And like, that's the port that frankly the power users are, right? And so like, this is actually an insight about the industry that I don't think really was crystallized like 3 years ago. Like, I think like 3 years ago when we were investing in this stuff, it was still a little bit more moonshotty from the standpoint of like, it was a very aspirational in terms of like where the market is. I think now there is a market. The problem is, I think there are a lot of people that don't accept that yet, right? There's some people for some reason that don't like that fact, but like the ones that do make money. So, I mean, that's a prerogative obviously for the founder. I think consumer AR, just because you said AR, VR, so that's kind of more like HMVs. I think consumer AR just doesn't exist at all. You know, because right now, like what you get sold as being AR is like, effectively like a smartphone filter, right? Like, you know, it's because your iPhone runs AR kit, it's quote unquote an AR device. And I think that's like one of the biggest like TAM fallacies that I see pitch decks. Like to the extent that like I almost have a reflexive reaction now that if I see a pitch deck and it says there are hundreds of millions of AR devices already in the world and there are no VR headsets, so we should build AR. I'm like, wrong. Like click away. It's just not valuable, right? But like so the counter argument people would of course always leverage me is, well, what about Pokemon Go?
Exactly.
Pokemon Go is, of course, like a widely successful, you know, it's made billions of dollars, right? It's effectively Niantic's entire existence is basically Pokemon Go. If you dig into it, you actually start to realize that Pokemon Go is effectively successful in spite of the quote unquote AR aspect to it, not because of it. So, like, you know, I've spoken to people familiar with Niantic that have quoted to me that something like 90% of people don't use the AR features in it, right? So obviously the gameplay is suitable. You know, they even had a big drop off in revenue when they got rid of their remote battle pass, whatever it was called, that basically enabled they doubled the price of this thing when it enabled users to actually like play in the game without actually going outside, right? Because it's a map based game, right? So it's kind of like a pass that let you actually like kind of play the game basically from your couch, right? And so they churned a lot of revenue, a lot of users when they actually doubled the price of that because their strategic thing was we want to get people outside, right? People didn't want to do it. So, you know, the more you kind of like dig through the data on Pokemon Go and then couple that with the fact that, you know, Niantic actually hasn't been able to really replicate the success of that game with, and they've tried, right? But they haven't really been able
Party to. Parts are in this, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. Where the argument is actually that, you know, Pokemon itself, of course, being like the biggest gaming IP ever, maybe that's why the game got carried, right? Because it's like, you know, they're basically benefiting off having a pseudo evergreen kind of, you know, event based Pokemon game mode, right? And players just like that, right? You know, they're more drawn to the IP. So, you know, Pokemon Go, I think even Niantic recently, I think earlier this year even mentioned that they're disabling the AR by default. So the default usage of it, I think this is in April, I read some article, something like this, so don't quote me on this, but I remember reading something in the direction that they actually disabled the AR features being like the out-of-the-box setting, right? It's something you have to go turn on, or they're not supporting some part of it anymore, so which kind of underscores it's clearly not an important feature for their gameplay. So that's the fallacy. And then you look beyond that, and it's like, there is no AR game. There is no successful consumer AR app, right? And so my deduction of it is just very common sense, right? It's that 3D in 2D is just not valuable, right? 3D in 3D is valuable, right? Like, so that's why you have like good apps in VR, right? That's why, like, even within VR, like, you know, I'm an investor in ShapesXR, which was really like the first quote unquote like design, like 3D design software to lean in completely to this concept, right? Like, their thing from the beginning was like, no web interface, right? Like the whole design process that runs in VR and headsets. And they're the ones that I think in this entire category have done the best. I think that's largely just because, you know, they leaned into that reality, right? That, like, you know, trying to use a 2D screen as a justification for TAM is actually like, it's a very quantitative VC way of looking at things, right? Uh-huh. It's not actually a practical way of looking at the market. And so, you know, I think until we get to AR glasses, which, you know, someone that worked on them at Meta, I will just say that I think it's still science fiction that will happen anytime soon. I don't think consumer AR is going to be a thing at all until that happens. So, you know, I know that's going to piss a lot of people off, and I tweeted a lot, and a lot of people don't like it, but it's just like it's the reality.
Yeah. Yeah, totally get your point. So how about enterprise and industrial side?
I mean, I spend less time there, but I think, like, what's definitely true, I mean, like, I think this is underscored. I don't know, maybe you saw this, that this company ArborXR just raised, like, a ton of money.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they're basically doing this, like, remote configuring of like, enterprise headsets and stuff. And, you know, I know some people working in that space as well that have mentioned that there's actually a lot of activity in that space. There's a lot of demand for these kind of, like, you know, remote provisioning of enterprise VR headsets and stuff, which I think one of the really underscored things on the in the VR market is the fact that there is actually a lot of enterprise and education demand for these things. I mean, education is actually a big one, right? Like you look at something like Prisms, and they're not the only ones. I've heard of a lot of kind of like school district appetite for VR based learning. Defense is one that I think is also gaining a lot of steam. You know, which also makes sense because, you know, things like, you know, there's one use case I'm well aware of, like the fighter jet, fighter pilot training stuff, you know, simulation. Like, naturally, stuff like that is just going to be better and more effective in some sort of portable 3D way, like in VR. Like, granted, I spent less time there because, you know, I think my personal inclination is just more towards consumer, but there again, like that's an area that definitely works, and I think there's money to be made there for founders if they're again approaching the right problem with the right solution. But like I think as long as I've been investing in VR, the one thing that definitely has always surprised me is the willingness that a lot of companies have to adopt VR-based solutions and buy headsets, and you know, so I would have thought from the beginning, like my first instinct was always like, but is the company going to buy a VR headset to do X, Y, and Z? And the answer always surprisingly has been yes, and a lot more than you would think if they're kind of convicted by it, it's a good solution for them. So, you know, I think, again, for founders that might watch this like and are thinking about companies, like I would not look at any of that stuff as like a barrier to entry, right, in terms of like, well, you know, enterprises are not going to buy headsets. Like they will buy headsets if you give them they are, and so I think that's something that's happening a lot more quietly than like the gaming side. I guess enterprise is just naturally more boring, right? So people talk about it less. But yeah, there's anybody you talk to that's kind of active on that side will tell you there's like a lot of activity in the enterprise side in VR.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So Arian, if you switch your side again and became a founder, what would you do in the current market of AR and VR?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, as a fund manager, I do kind of look at myself as a bit of a founder where I'm like, we are kind of founders. You know, we have a very particular business model, I guess, right? Or like there's a business model, of course, that we're married to. So,
of course.
So, you know, my kind of cheeky answer would be, well, you know, I started a fund, so that's kind of what I'd want to do, right? And also, like I mentioned before, like, I have like very little appetite to be like a company, like more kind of traditional startup founder again, at least at this point. So like for me, nothing is particularly attractive. But I mean, I don't know. I think it kind of depends what direction you want to go. Like kind of like I mentioned, like, you know, kind of maybe removing myself a little bit from like my own personal skill set and just like kind of, you know, why I think they're like good opportunities to make money. To build a good business, kind of like I mentioned before, like I think VR studios right now, like built on Arc Insights, is just a really, really terrific opportunity where, you know, you can with a small team make a lot of money. Like you need very minimal VC, you're not going to be dependent on that, right? But you can basically build a company that can have like a VC kind of trajectory, which is, of course, I think quite exciting. Like, you know, I've written before, like on my Substack about how I think like the first like quote unquote like proverbial $1 billion company is actually going to be a VR studio.
Exactly.
And I would actually argue that, you know, if you're using the term more proverbially, it kind of might already be like another axiom, right? But so that to me is like just personally, like I think a very interesting opportunity from that sense. I think in terms of things that just intellectually interest me right now, it's definitely a little bit more down the robotics direction. I think specifically, you know, things like teleoperations of hardware, you know, like one company that I really love was this company, another Carbon Origins, which, yeah, you know, they're using, you know, VR headsets to like remote control these like caterpillars and stuff and construction sites. I'm like, this is super cool, right? You know, so something kind of in that direction that again kind of fuses all these concepts of, you know, VR, AI, and robotics, and kind of really sits in the middle there. You know, kind of thinking a little bit about the insight that, you know, VR is the only digital device on the planet, or like you should say, like kind of like a broader like VR headset with controllers and whatever, that can really capture like more human behavioral data than any device in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and it, particularly if you tie that back to robotics and saying that a lot of robotics, of course, is like just leveraging exactly that kind of data that you're getting out of VR headsets. There's something perhaps interesting there infrastructurally, right, in terms of, you know, how do you feel like, and again, this is kind of very spitballing, but like there's clearly businesses you can build around that, right, on the data side of things, because data is the gold, right, you know, and so... Mm-hmm. Is there a play to, for example, facilitate like data management of, you know, like VR-based data for like, you know, robotics slash hardware training, right? That would leverage a kind of human behavioral data. I think those are, that's kind of like an interesting angle that I think about a lot. But yeah, I think for me, it would definitely like intellectually kind of go more in the robots direction of like, you know, how do we keep enabling a lot of these robotics trends that we have going on right now? Like, can we leverage VR and AI to do that? I think that's where a lot of my curiosity would go.
Awesome. So what's your take, Arian, on the hardware side of AR and VR right now?
In terms of
the gadgets that are available, Apple Vision Pro, Meta Quest, and et cetera.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, let's put it this way. I think all the hardware, like, I think there's this constant debate, obviously, within VR land about, you know, there's a camp of people that believes that the biggest inhibitor to VR adoption is just the form factor, the weight, right? The hardware's not good enough. And then there's another side that believes it's a content problem.
Yeah.
I would say I tend to fall more in the middle of that. Conversation mm-hmm. where like my base belief is that right now it's primarily a content problem, but it's a trade-off, right? So in other words, because the hardware is at a certain level of like, let's say like discomfort and or whatever kind of like inconvenient form factor, your bar for content to convince people to overcome that weakness, right, to use your software basically, is probably higher. Right, so like your software needs to be really extraordinary right now to convince people. Fortunately, we know what some of those things are. So the better the hardware gets, maybe the lower the bar gets for you to actually start making like a commercially viable app, right? Because you know people now should be spending more time, and there's less friction to put on the headset, so they're willing to try more things and spend more time in different things, right? Like so, that's my general theory. So that is to say that I think if you kind of like, let's say reduce down, I mean, really the only like headset right now that's really important is the Quest. I think everything else is kind of, from a commercial perspective, relatively irrelevant. You know, I think that this speaks for some, I mean, they just own the market, right? Like, I mean, it's like, you know, that's the only place where you actually have an install base where you can really like, you have a user base that's big enough to build a viable business. Assuming you're doing consumer, the Vision Pro, for example, I think, you know, you're obviously like, you know, I'm seeing more and more founders that, you know, are kind of drilled on the Vision Pro. And like, I mean, I will say I like the Vision Pro as a whole. I think it's, you know, it's, I definitely do not think that it's consumer viable. You know, like I'm used to wearing headsets, so like I don't care. And like, for me, actually, I prefer to put on the Vision Pro than I do a Quest, to be perfectly honest, but it's just, I have nothing to do on it other than like mirror my screen and watch TV basically. But, it's not consumer viable in its current state. It's just too heavy, right? Like a normal person's not going to wear that. And then they also have the problem of not really having an app ecosystem, right? And this is kind of like a bit of a vicious cycle that they're in, right? Because like VR startups are not well funded. Most of these companies are building in the Quest where they make money. There are not a lot of users in the Vision Pro. Like a lot of actually even the apps that are successful in the Quest probably won't really work as ports in the Vision Pro. Like games, for example, like where like the Vision Pro is very like intent on, we don't want games, basically. We don't care about games. So there's just not a lot of appetite really to put like the limited budgets a lot of these companies have to put so much R&D money into a platform that just, first of all, does not have a lot of users, but especially like for the most part will not actually have a user base that intersects with theirs that they have on the Quest. And so you have this problem that like nobody actually wants to build for it, and like one of the biggest problems, of course, is that, or I should say, like people want to build for it, like more kind of the indie hackers, so like kind of the more serious kind of studios, right, like are less inclined to do so on the consumer side. And you're kind of in the cycle of nobody buys it, one of the big reasons being because there are not a lot of things to do with it, right? There's just not a lot of apps. But then also because there are not a lot of people in it, nobody wants to build for it, right? And you get this kind of like this vicious cycle of that. And so I think that's the biggest problem that Apple has to solve now, because I think I thought from the beginning that the Vision Pro is going to be more of a dev kit kind of thing. I think that's what it was always kind of positioned to be, right? Like, I think if you look at one and you hold one, you realize that, like, and just even the way it was priced, this thing was never designed to be a mass consumer product, right? I mean, that was even obvious from the beginning. They said they're going to make like 500,000, right? Like, so they're not expecting it to a mass consumer if they're only manufacturing 500,000 of them in a year, right? So my theory was always that the people that will buy this thing are developers and effectively enthusiasts, right? And it's kind of like a means for Apple. And again, maybe I'm giving them too much credit here, but like for Apple to put this device out there, to put their OS out there, and to sort of start that ecosystem flywheel, mm-hmm. right? Because you have some of the hobbyists built for it, right? And it kind of like sort of starts to move. I don't know if that's actually happening for the reasons that I mentioned. And so I think that's like the biggest problem that Apple has to debug, right? Because I'm sure that what they want is by the time they do come with like a more lightweight, kind of cheaper, consumer viable version of the headset in a few years, that it's already pretty well loaded with like a few, like a lot of use cases that they can tap into. A lot of apps and stuff and whatever, and that's a little bit more established, but like I don't know how they're going to get there right now. And so like that's something that, from the software side. And so that's something that I think Apple needs to think about. You know, in terms of like, what is the strategy there? How the hell did we entice people to build for this thing? Like, did we maybe miscalculate some things in the market that that makes people not want to build for this? And so that's the issue with the Vision Pro. But I think like looking forward, of course, it's a very good thing. I think it is the best device qualitatively on the market. It's definitely a glimpse into the future, and I think Apple, generally speaking, if you look past some of the bad specs in it, has done a pretty good job, I think, of laying out with it like what really the future of computing is supposed to be, right? And a lot of the concepts we talked about is just, you know, it's just very primitive from where it needs to be, right? And so just sort of the foil to that, I think Apple is big screen.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And of course, the big screen is interesting because, you know, they've basically taken the, and I think this is actually like the more time I spend in VR, the more I just become convinced that this general way of looking at things right now is true. It's like focusing on quality over quantity. Like, you know, there's always this obsession with like venture markets that it's all about, everything's about scale all the time. But like, there's not a lot of focus on just like the quality, right? And like, what I think big screen has done is that, well, you know, they do this whole face fitting thing and all of that, right? And it's super lightweight, where, how do you scale that to selling hundreds of millions of these? I don't know, right? But it does sort of have like some sort of insight that that's probably what the ideal version of this, of like a form factor, looks like right now, is something like in the big screen direction. Like, you know, what is it weigh, like 60 grams or something, right? It's like super lightweight.
Exactly.
And it's like fit to your face. Like, you know, everybody loves it. You know, so the question is like, how do you take those two realities and, you know, kind of from like the more mass consumer side of things, but then also big screens doing, right, from the kind of form factor side, and try to find some sort of middle ground that, you know, kind of the next big step, like in the way like the Quest 2 was.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think is kind of like the next big frontier to cross.
Awesome. So what do you think about Meta Ray-Ban? Do you also consider it in this category?
You know, I find it hilarious because I actually spent most of my time at Meta working on the Ray-Bans. And I used to always complain that like, I'm like, this thing is completely useless. Like, this is a completely useless device. Like, why would anybody buy this? And so, you know, I was still at the company when they shipped the first version of it. So now, obviously, the one that's been quite popular is the V2, obviously. So like, I'm not around for that. But I was there for the V1, and I think the V1 like was largely like that, right? It was like nobody really knew why it existed, right? It was like, it's an interesting like view to the future, right? But in and of itself, it's not a particularly useful one. This one, this last one seems to have done very, very well. And, you know, I think one of the trends that Meta really benefited from is this whole AI thing. Right? Because really all, like, if you really think about it, like really for the most part, all these things are, is they just put like an LLM in your, into your glasses that you can run, right? Like you talk to it and whatever, right? And that's kind of like the biggest innovation of it, right? Which is all the stuff that Meta, for all intents and purposes, already had in-house. Now, of course, what Meta cracked, right, is of course you've seen a lot of weird iterations of this, right? From the AI pin to Rabbit to some extent to even this friend thing that just came out kind of weird, right? Like, where it's principally the same idea as they're trying to wrap LLMs with some sort of sensory input, right? As hardware and sort of package as a product. I think the thing that you can learn from the Ray-Bans is that the glasses form factor is the one that's actually worked the best. And that also shouldn't be particularly surprising because, of course, a lot of the benefit of what this AI can do, right, and this particular, this multimodal stuff that you see going on, right, which ties again back into this like action-based spatial intelligence stuff we're talking before, is it's the most natural way to actually be in sync with the technology and your own perception, right? You know, I'm looking at something and like I want to figure out what that is, right, or whatever, and you know, so it's a lot more natural for me to talk to the glasses there.
I see.
And so, so that's, I think, one reason that's actually successful, that just having it, like, sitting on your face is a good thing. The other thing that I thought that, and I, this is something I always liked about the project from the beginning, even when I was dumping on the functionality of the device internally, was to do it with Ray-Bans, right? Because Ray-Bans are a style symbol. Everybody wears them, right? So you can kind of put this technology on your face in a way that's still completely socially normal, right? Like, people wear Ray-Bans, right? Okay, great. Now you wear Ray-Bans that have, you know, a chip in them and then have some technical functionality. That was probably always going to be the best way to try to break into something, into wearables, frankly. I mean, like the Apple Watch is another example. Like most people wear Apple Watches not because of the tech, but because they like how it looks.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so Apple, like, investing in the design of it was probably a very good idea, right? Meta's smart enough to realize, well, we're not really designing people in-house, so let's outsource it to Ray-Ban to do that. And that was a smart idea. Whereas like the other devices look ridiculous. Like, I mean, the AI pin, like, you know, it's well documented what some of the issues with that are, right? The friend thing, like, who wants to wear a necklace? Kind of, again, strange, right? Like the Rabbit thing, why would you carry a second phone to interact with your phone? It doesn't make any sense, right? So, so that wedge is, as kind of like something that is already very natural to people, which is to wear sunglasses. And again, particularly with the insight also being that you're more likely to wear your Ray-Bans, or like the usage is really more also geared towards like the outside and exploring, which is also again like something that like your VR headset can't do, for example, aspirationally. Makes a lot of sense. And like, hey, you're just tying it into a device that most people already wear when they go outside, like sunglasses. I think it's an important insight. And that's actually frankly why I'm quite bullish on the glasses form factor as a whole. And just Meta happened to be the first and only company to approach the problem space in that kind of way. You know, so the big takeaway that I have is there anything super special about the tech? From what I've seen, in my opinion, no. But is the form factor, the way they're packaging it, the most effective way? Yes. I think that's kind of the way I would sum it up from my point of view.
Awesome, awesome. So, Arian, how do you see AI with recent advancements augmenting AR and VR, for example, with LLMs that you mentioned, or technologies like NeRF and 3D Gaussian splattings with digital twins and etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a ton of applications for these things, right? I mean, like, so you can start a very simple one, which is, you know, let's say you go down the VR path and you say, hey, like, part of the promise of VR, of course, is like, you know, digital world scale, right? Like, you know, let's take something like GTA 5, right, which is a game that took 5-6 years to develop. You can't even go inside of buildings and it's a slice of a geography, right? So basically what that tells you is you can't actually build world scale coverage with just people quietly, right? So tools like this will just aid the actual development process. Like a
exactly.
obviously, right? So that's like kind of like one application, right? The other is, you know, that's when we go to the LLM side, right? Again, a lot of this is based on multimodal understanding of your environments, right? And like, so that's why I always say, like, when you, all these things are pushing multimodality now, I always tell people, like, where do you think that is supposed to end up, right? It's just, it's a brain that it's a computer that all of a sudden has, like, the understanding that you do of your environment, right? And so, like, that just enables all these, again, like, these insights that you can build actions on, you know, you can lay it over or whatever, right? And so, you know, that I think is just, like, a big application generally, like understanding. I think the other thing, and this is, like, particularly also, and again, all this to some extent also applies to robotics. Which is why we say that VR and robotics are actually like opposite ends of the same spectrum, actually, right? But like the other thing is just the communication layer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, again, particularly we go back to world scale or we go to some sort of like instruction about, you know, what am I looking at? What am I like trying to get the computer to do something? All of a sudden, you're able to communicate with the computer in natural language.
Uh-huh.
Which makes it accessible to most people because that was never possible, right? To instruct a computer was not something a layman could do, right? Like now all of a sudden you can do that. And so there's this layer now between natural language, computer instruction, process, return to natural language, right? Like, and that's just a very, very big unlock, right? And so like the obvious use case for that, for example, is like consumer robotics, right? You know, mm-hmm. on Android, whatever. You know, I could build robots now where I could like have a thing that says, please do my dishes, right? And like, all of a sudden just do it, right? That wasn't possible before because you just didn't have the tech out of the box to do that. So I think, I mean, it just kind of impacts everything and from insight and actual just like process, right? Like the way you can sort of like interface with technology is completely changed. And I think that's kind of like the more operative thing. Like if I have to summarize that point, is just like you have a much, much more advanced interface into technology now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a lot of ways to apply that.
Uh-huh.
For VR specifically, I think it's more like the, you know, the generation, the AI-driven NPCs, right? Dynamic, you know, world creation, world development, right? Like a lot of interesting things going on that just make, you know, you could say make virtual worlds feel more hyper-realistic rather than static, right? Like
exactly.
You know, that's kind of the more obvious application, but again, I think it's just transcended depending on what direction you want to go.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So, Arian, what's your advice for founders in AR and VR startups looking to raise funds?
Yeah, first of all, don't do AR unless you're doing something like it's very specific, very, very specifically in enterprise. I think that the biggest insight that I could give people right now is that nobody wants to invest in these things. I think there may be 5 people that want to and like 10 people that are willing to, you know, like if you're talking like first fundraisers, right? And that's like really it. That's like your investor pool. And so what a lot of founders have to understand is that this is not 21 anymore and there's no more metaverse hype. And it's effectively become an investor's market because of that, right? And so like me, even as a pre-seed investor, I primarily get to just invest in like the best studios that exist, you know, like that's just what's on the market for me, because like that's just what the market is skewed towards because there's such little capital for these kinds of companies. And so that is an important thing to understand, I think, for 2 reasons. One is it's fine, I think, to like first is just understand that what you're doing is actually venture scale or not. I think issues that I see with a lot of pre-seed decks that I see is that they're building companies that I think could be decent companies,
mm-hmm.
given the size of the market and all of that, and the opportunity, the expertise and stuff the team has. But like at this stage in time, they're not venture scale opportunities. And I think a lot of people have fallen to the stop pattern that venture scale equals good and like not venture scale equals bad, which is like not the case at all. Like you can have a perfectly good business that's not venture scale. Most of them aren't. But you know, it's a different model, right? Like, you know, venture scale means that, you know, you will grow over a certain period of time into hopefully $1 billion outcome, and that upside needs to be there. For a lot of people that pitch businesses, that's just not the case. And I think there are a few categories where that is the case. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is understanding there's not a lot of capital, and like because of that, even if you do well and you manage to raise a tranche of capital, like at this point, I don't know where your second tranche of capital is coming from. And so There needs to be, I think, a bias towards profitability and just stay like surviving and growing. And again, like in a lot of studios that we have never need to actually raise again because they're just hyper profitable and have a lot of money that they've just on their balance sheet basically, and that's it. So kind of thinking about basically capital management is what I would call that, is like being acknowledging that there's not a lot of money out there. And the second, I think the sort of building off that, kind of like the last thing, is just understanding that because there's not a lot of investors right now in the market for this stuff, like your competition's really high. And unless you have, and a lot of what us as investors are doing are just trying to underwrite the best people in the space. And so a lot of times I get pitched by people, for example, that they might have interesting ideas that I find cool, right? But they don't, for example, have like any sort of background that I can go off in terms of like, they've executed before, right? They have like a reputation, like they're kind of either they have like random backgrounds or they're pretty new or young or whatever. And then they also don't really have traction, right? And like by traction, particularly like at the early stages, I'm very interested in like distribution, right? Like, do these people have a distributor title or whatever, right? And it's just so I'm like, it's interesting, but I have nothing to underwrite. And so in a hot market, maybe deals like that get done because again, there's a lot of activity for like some of the more established, better studios, right? So, some of that like early investors have to kind of push down and take different kinds of shots. We're not in that environment right now. Like deals that are getting done are people that are like coming with like, we have some track record, we have some traction, right? Like, we have graphs to show that go in the right direction. And like everything is stack ranked, right? And so the five investors, like a couple times a year, get presented deals like that. Those are the ones that they're going to do. And so the issue that I think I see with a lot of pre-seed founders there in that regard is they're like kind of overestimating themselves in the market. And but while not well, again, there's some markets where this might be true. Like maybe right now you can go into like build an AI, maybe not even anymore, but maybe like 12 months ago, you could have built like an AI company with not a lot on the bone and raised like $1 million, $2 million or so. That's not true in VR. And so I think there needs to be this emphasis on like we actually need to prove that we could build this thing and like tangibly demonstrate that before we would try to ask VCs for money. And don't get sidetracked by angel investors. Like I've seen this a lot too, that there's a company that's really not ripe to raise $1.2 million in VR, but there's some angel that gave them 50 grand. Because of that, they think they're like that they're going to raise $2 million in VR, right? And it's again, just not true. So there's a lot there, but basically, I would like focus on in summary, like venture scale opportunity, capital management, and then like some focus on demonstrate like being able to demonstrate like distribution or traction in the game. And so typically I would say most pitches fall short on one of those
I
attributes,
see. I see.
which makes them hard to invest in. So that's like the summary of the three things I focus on.
I see. Awesome. So I've got a ton of questions, Arian, but I know your time's running out. So
Unfortunately.
as of our last question, how do you see the VC industry changing with the current advancements in AI? You mentioned the solopreneur, the solo founder unicorn, and also with new advancements in AI, it's easier than ever to create an MVP. It's easier to have smaller teams and have less costs. What do you
Totally.
think about the VC industry changing by these factors?
Well, so one of the bets that I'm making, and I think something I'm predicating a lot of our strategy on, and like even when I pitch LPs this, is that listen, like this is a reality that's changing. We have examples of it in our portfolio, right? Companies that started small and have just made a crap ton of money and they don't have to raise again, right? Where they're just gonna, we think a lot of the winners kind of this generation of like of kind of post the shift are just going to be ones that raise once, and so they don't follow the traditional venture path anymore, right? Pre-seed and you get to seed and you get to Series A and you get to Series B, right? And you kind of just go stage by stage, where that kind of gets wiped out, and like it gets completely rethought because like having companies that it's, you know, 3 years in, they're five people and they make $20 million a year is kind of something pretty out of distribution, but this is going to be like pretty, I think, more normative for a lot of the great companies. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Like, I think there's certain types of businesses that are more conducive to that than others. But like, really, the consequence is going to be is that you're going to have more companies that only raise like an initial tranche of capital and then never need to raise money again. Which actually kind of increases, in my opinion, the urgency to even invest early, right? Because if you don't invest in that first round, like, which is basically pre-seed, like, you might never get access to that winner. Yeah. And so, like, in many cases, you'll have like some of the mega funds, right, that are predicated on the idea of, you know, buying huge ownership stakes in companies that are kind of like early winners might not exist anymore. Like, or like, it just might happen less frequently, right? So I think it's actually something that, in my opinion, is going to impact the kind of downstream, you know, kind of call it like Series A, Series B, maybe even like kind of pure seed investing a lot more than it is pre-seed. And actually, I think it underscores that it's like there's probably no better time to be pre-seed. So that's again, it's a bet that I'm making largely that like we're just going to see more of that, but you know, which I think is actually good for founders, but you know, let's see.
Yeah, totally agree. So Arian, how can our listeners contact you and reach to you and Earthling VC?
Yeah, just email is good. So it's my first name, Arian at earthling.vc, Twitter,
awesome.
You know, and then, you know, I can send that to you, just kind of link it. Very active on Twitter. DM me on Twitter, not on LinkedIn. I always take Twitter as kind of fire signal, fire signal. Yeah. DMs, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. We'll surely put links on the description of the podcast. So, Arian, it was great having you on the All Things XR podcast. Thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks.